Hello and welcome to the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast for the 24th of September 2017. My name is TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Alice from Traffic Light Theatre Goer. We're now going to talk about Boudicca by Tristan Bernays at Shakespeare's Globe. This play is directed by Eleanor Rode, with design by Tom Piper, and music composed by Jules Maxwell. It stars Gina McKee as Boudicca and Joan Iola as Alona and Natalie Simpson as Blodwyn, Boudicca's daughters. We also have Forbes Masson playing Cuno Baleen, Abraham Popola playing Badvok, two of Boudicca's allies in her rebellion against Roman Britain, and Clifford Samuel as Suetonius, or Suetonius Paulinus, I think he was, the Roman general who is governor of Britain and eventually defeats Boudicca. Sorry if that's a spoiler. We also have Anna Maria Naberi as Andraste, the Icenae goddess of war, on whom Boudicca used to call before going into a battle. The rest of the cast include Bethan Clark, Samuel Collins, Owen Findlay, Jenny Fitzpatrick, Kate Handford, Brian Martin, and Tok Stephen. This play, as might be expected, a retelling of the rebellion against Roman rule that Boudicca, or Boadicea, when I was a very young child, carried out in about the AD 1661, where she actually fought back against them. We are introduced to this play with a prologue from Andraste, where she tells us that the Romans have been there for 100 years. Well, it doesn't quite say that, but it says that they first invaded 100 years before, which is true. Julius Caesar invaded Britain twice. The first time he basically camped out for the day, and then the second time he actually attacked a tribe, defeated them, installed a client king, and then extracted tribute for the next century from that particular tribe, the Trinovantes, I think they were. But it sort of hand waves a little bit and doesn't mention some people. The crucial person to mention is the Emperor Claudius. He is mentioned briefly, but they don't actually mention that he is the person who in 43 AD, that's about 80 years after Julius Caesar, actually did invade and did conquer Britain and began the Roman settlement and the Romanization of Britain, building the capital at one of the major towns, which was Camulodunum, which is modern-day Colchester. This brings up one of the problems, because I'm a bit of a history sensitive, so if you start hand-waving about history, like saying, oh, the Romans have been here for 100 years, I'm going to start counting on my fingers and working out, no, actually, they've only been there for 17 years, because that's when Claudius conquered Britain. So what was known as a colonia, where they basically put lots of ex-soldiers and built up a town, the colonia that they built at Colchester was only there for 17 years. And there is a particular thing in this play where one of Boudicca's daughters takes a slave, rescues a young Roman woman who's supposed to have been born and bred in Colchester. Only the thing is that would mean you should need to be 16, and this is a 16-year-old woman with a well-established marriage to a doctor. So the thing is that what he's trying to do here is make the points about maybe Brexit, about incomers, about refugees, about immigrants. Once you realise that's what he's doing, it kind of feels as if he's simply bending the facts to make his point, and that always upsets me a lot. You know, he's hand-waved, he's trying to say that the Romans were well-established when they weren't. I mean, it's 17 years, it's as if they arrived in the year 2000. They're not well-established, they are incomers. Anyone born and bred in Roman Colchester would be 16, and he doesn't acknowledge this. He just hand waves and hopes that nobody notices, and so he better not get Mary Beard in, who he'll probably heckle. So we are in a play that is trying to tell us a little bit about the real world in the story of Boudicca. Now, the story of Boudicca is that she is the wife of the king of the Iceni. The king of the Iceni dies, and she wants to take over as queen of the Iceni and pass it on to her two daughters. Unfortunately, when she goes to the Roman prefect in Colchester, and I'm going to keep calling Colchester rather than Camulodunum, I'm afraid. She is whipped and her daughters are raped. This is one of the things that is known about Boudicca. There's a very sketchy idea of exactly what she did other than the three towns she destroys and also the final battle. Nobody actually knows where the final battle took place, and apparently it was a quite major battle. So she then goes to two allies, Cunobeline and a character called Badvok of the Belgae. It's a bit unfortunate, A, because the Belgae makes them sound like as if they're from Belgium, although they weren't, they were from Wiltshire. And also, Badvok was the name of Rory McGrath's character in the sitcom Chelmsford 123, which also looked at Roman Britain. So it's a rather unfortunate name, or at least it is for me. I think I'm not sure that that's going to mean a lot to an awful lot of people. But it is a proper Celtic name, so it's acceptable. These characters, there's certainly a lot of tension between them. They don't really trust each other. There's an awful lot of pride, and they do have a little bit of difficulty getting on with Boudicca as queen. I mean, certainly Cunobeline is a lot nicer, but Badvok really just wants to fight Romans on his own terms and doesn't really want to have to put up with anybody else. They destroy Colchester. They then move on to London. London was a slightly smaller town at the time, but that's where the Romans are concentrated. There isn't a big enough army, either in Colchester or in London, to come up against the Celtic tribes rebelling, and London is destroyed. They also move on to St. Albans, which is known as Verulamium. And this is all happening while Suetonius is doing other things. He famously goes up into Wales and defeats the Druids. We don't really get a good picture of what he does there or what the Druids did or whether the Druids are good or bad people or anything like that. I don't think the playwright here is interested in them. And there's certainly a lot of interesting things to be said about Suetonius's attack on the Druids. They're eventually defeated at Anglesey. I think they're defeated on the beaches at the Menai Straits. And because he is distracted by that, he's not able to bring his legions in. And by the time he does, he's up against maybe 100,000, it's estimated, Celtic warriors, and he's got a few thousand people. The odds are something like 10 to 1. So he finds it rather difficult, but because of strategy, because he's got well-disciplined troops, he is able eventually to defeat them. I mean, essentially what he does is he channels all of the Celtic soldiers into a very narrow area. He is protected on two sides by the terrain and forests and, you know, forests and rocks and things like that. So they can't get behind him. They can't come at him at the side. They have to go on a full-on attack, and the Roman soldiers simply hold their position, and basically the Celts just keep coming at them, and some of them, when they turn back, find they can't turn back and they get crushed, so eventually they all get killed. So that's a historical side of this. What we have here in the play is Tristan Bernays, he's often mixing poetic, keep wanting to say back formation, where you swap around word order to make it sound more poetic and more like Cod Shakespeare. And he's also mixed in some vernacular or demotic, I like that word, phrases, so that we get sort of a lot of rough and ready. And, you know, there's occasional nice phrases that he comes up with. And even some phrases, I believe there's one phrase which I think is borrowed perhaps from Antony and Cleopatra. I mean, the idea of Boudicca says at one point, he mouths me, which I think is from Antony and Cleopatra. So I didn't particularly like that. I thought it was a bit rough. I thought it was that language is not, it didn't quite work for me. What works for me but much better are the performances. Gina McKee as Boudicca is very good. Her daughters are very well played. I did have a slight problem with the character of Alona, played by Joan Iola. She suddenly turns into somebody who doesn't want any kind of war and wants to make peace. I was being told that that's what she was doing. I wasn't being shown her decision process. She just suddenly decided that. And we also get another thing where Boudicca decides that although Alona is the younger one, she prefers her to be queen rather than her older sister, who's Blodwyn, who is much more violent and much more passionate about getting rid of the Romans. What this play does is it does present both sides of the immigrant argument. Are immigrants always acceptable? Are they acceptable once they become well integrated in society? This idea of being born and bred in the country. And you shift your loyalty between the Romans and the ancient Britons, and I think it works really quite well. It's a good production. They have a couple of Clash songs in there, London Calling. is done at the beginning of the second act, when they're just about to attack London. I've got quibbles about it because I know too much about history and I don't like to see cod Shakespeare, but the overall production by Eleanor Road I thought was extremely good. What did you think about it, Alice?
Well, my headline on this was clunky but funky. I enjoyed it. I mean, I don't know quite as much in quite as much detail the history of things, and it did probably play fast and loose with what we know of the real events. But at the same time, we're used to Game of Thrones and all those swashbuckling, mythological, historical TV serials which are coming out now of Britain and of America, and like a sort of updated Errol Flynn or something. So I think this is a crowd pleaser. And one thing I did really impress me was that this fills the globe stage, the whole globe environment, which is a very, very impressive thing for new writing. There have been a few modern plays at the Globe, which have been, of course, acclaimed. But this really felt like something which was, okay, it was cod Shakespearean, but at the same time, it was enjoyable, it was vigorous, it had its faults. I think, actually, the verse wasn't too bad, the verse element, because I spoke to people around me and some of them hadn't even noticed. And I think it just flowed. So that was pretty good. I think it feels like actually a Shakespearean subject, which was also something which I found quite intriguing. You know, you have the proud queen united the British tribes against the might of the Roman Empire. Of course, it is something that's come down to us in a way that whatever the particular take at the time in Victorian times or before that was, that they've appropriated it for their own purposes. So I think those who know about Boudicca, or like you, in my childhood when I was taught at primary school, we called her Boadicea, that kind of mixed up version works. But it is something for the double-edged Brexit age. I do also feel there was a bit, in fact, the discussion about the woman who has been born and brought up in Britain, the Roman woman, was also a little bit like a discussion about colonialism as well, and the aftermath of colonialism, which of course is very appropriate for the Romans in Britain. I thought it was well directed by Eleanor Road, and as I say, it was very vigorous. It just went from point to point to point. It is a tad unsubtle, but, you know, as I say, it follows a little bit a television-like structure, and there is a modern mashup. But I think it still, it demands to be taken on its own terms. You know, it's a tale of adventure and betrayal, even though it does insert some more thoughtful details about war, colonialism, maybe Brexit, immigration, and so forth. I think the writer Tristan Bernays actually says himself in the programme that he wanted to make a kind of blockbuster action film on stage, and with women, battling women at its centre. And I think in that he does succeed. And I think there's also, with the, as you say, the London Calling, the Clash song, it's a bit out of sync with the rest of the play. But at the same time, it's a pleasing working of the audience, as if they are the British tribes who are rallying. Gina McKee at one point, as Boudicca, also does a kind of Henry V mixed with Elizabeth I's speech to rouse the tribes. I felt that at the centre, Gina McKee's role was a bit thinly written. It felt a little bit as a vacuum. But again, this felt more like screenwriting, television writing, and it was about action. I didn't at first actually catch on that the narrator was Andraste. This was played by Anna Maria Nabeira. But actually, that didn't mar anything for me, because I just felt that she was dressed in the uniform of African rebels and child soldiers, and she was narrating, as you say, the prologue, a little bit about Boudicca and what had happened. As I say, I was taken with the story. It went from point to point to point. So you have Boudicca arriving with her two daughters. I thought the daughters were pretty well played. I think Natalie Simpson, in fact, had played a slightly similar part in Cymbeline at the RSC. But, you know, there was the contrast between the two daughters. And, of course, it starts with this rape. I did slightly wonder, although I'm saying that I'm not taking much note of the actual history, how rape would have been viewed at that time, whether it would have been viewed as violation or whether it would have been viewed as something else. That did occur to me. I don't know whether it would have occurred to others in the audience, but I was prepared to accept that it was also taking on the huge subject of rape as a weapon of war as well, and subjugation, which sadly remains to our days. I think there's quite a versatile wooden stage set. It's quite plain. There's not really much in it, but I think it's the right setting. It's designed by Tom Piper, and there were ladders as well. Lots and lots of action, which really suits the Globe. As I say, it filled the Globe, and people were enjoying it and were enjoying the action. There's some aerial work as well, which I won't completely give away, but it did bounce along. It's not an especially complex subtext, and a lot of things, the modern mashup, it was signposted, you know, a mile away. But again, those historical and mythological stories that you now get on TV and in film, they've conditioned us to this kind of mashup and artistic license. As you say, the use of the word Belgics for the chief of the tribe of the Belgics, it does have a resonance now. I have a feeling it was left in a bit deliberately just for the resonance with Belgium, rather than making a detailed comment about Brexit. But I did feel that was a kind of deliberate insertion. I really liked as well the chief of the Belgics, played by Abraham Papoula, and he was a kind of charismatic, and he was a punk, really. He was a huge tree trunk of a man. I think he had the line, "There's madness and there's badvok." And the jokes were sometimes a bit Monty Python, Blackadder. It did have a feel of parody at times, but with a bit more swearing, I have to say. I mean, at one point, somebody dashes in with a message and somebody shouts out, "Honey, of course he's got news. He's the F asterisk, 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 whatever, messenger." As I say, the characters are not the most complicated of characters a lot of the time. It is drawn to be like an action movie. And there's one point when the goddess does descend. It actually reminded me a bit of Salad Days, I have to say, with this sci-fi element. But again, it didn't actually mar the experience. I think, as I said, it's sort of clunky. But funky, I mean, there's always another piece of action to take the audience's attention. And the twists and turns, yes, they're quite unsubtle. And perhaps it tries to pile in a bit too many issues. But it is bringing a TV genre, drawing on classic literature, back onto the Shakespearean stage. And another thing I would say is that, unusually as well, it probably could work in even bigger venues. And I wouldn't often say that. Usually with new writing, there's an issue about a little play expanded. This didn't have that feel at all. And all in all, I thought it was a good, crowd-pleasing reinvention of ancient historical events.
We're now going to talk about Dolphins and Sharks at the Finborough Theatre. This is the European premiere of a play by James Anthony Taylor and is directed here by Lydia Parker with set and costume design by Anna Driftmeyer. It stars Shaiko Amos, Emilio Miguel Aquino, Mikael Brown, Amar Dufus and Rachel Hanshaw. The setting, and it's really quite a nicely realised setting, I think, is a shop called Harlem Office. It's an office supply and copying and print shop run in Harlem. It's part of a chain of similar office stores. They're small neighbourhood stores. They do basic design services. They have computers that people can go on. Into this comes a recent philosophy graduate called Yusuf. He's looking at having to pay massive student loans, so he badly needs a job. Unfortunately, he sort of turned up late for his interview for this, and these are the only people who've taken any interest in him. And he encounters Zimora, who is a Dominican woman who is charged with interviewing him and doesn't really want to give him a chance at first, but decides to take a chance on him eventually. She and her office mate, Isabel's been working there for 6 years. She's a very popular figure in the print shop, helping people out. And she has sort of some seniority to Zimora. But Zimora wants to go for the recently vacated office manager's job, which she eventually gets. And this causes trouble and friction. The other characters are a cleaner who is also Dominican, an older woman called Amenze Eman, who is trying to protect the local area from encroaching gentrification and encroaching, shall we say, well, it's occasionally said, you know, the white influx into Harlem, which is sometimes detailed here. And she's part of trying to keep it the way it was and to respect the history of Harlem and not to have too much gentrification. But unfortunately, this office supply place and this, you know, small copy shop is really being driven towards the same kind of gentrification and becoming more and more professional and perhaps more and more soulless. We see the effects of that on the workers within the store. We never see any of their bosses, who are the white people, certainly the big boss that Zimora has constantly to defer to is a white man, and it does cause a lot of friction. And we also have quite a lot of laughs. Alice, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I thought it had a brilliant premise. I think in the end it does trip itself up, writing-wise. That's to say that it was a bit of an uneasy patchwork of issues and actions. As with so much new writing that I see now, I did feel that the writing had the feel of a movie rather than a stage play. But I thought that Lydia Parker, the director, did a splendid job with the direction, and there was a lot of clarity there. I just thought that the whole concept was so good, and that carried a lot of the play and, of course, the performances as well. I think on one of the doors of Anna Driftmeyer's very detailed and very good set, actually, that there's a glimpse of the outside on the side wall, but you then go into the print shop through a door. And it's a kind of printers come photocopying place that you would recognize from a lot of places, not just Harlem. And on the door, there is a notice tape saying back to school sale. And at the beginning, there is some concentration, of course, on the student loans, which I think this is a play that emerged about 2015. Where at the time it's worth knowing that the federal government privatized student loans in America, took it away from the federal companies who had been providing it. And this, I felt, was a comment as well on this situation, especially with the notice saying back to school sale. You have the young Yusuf, played by Amar Dufas, and of course he's come out with what would be deemed a useless degree by some, a degree in philosophy. In the end, there's a twist with his place in the play, which of course I won't give away, but shows the kind of straits that some find themselves in. And the play itself, it is a bit heavy-handed, even the title, Dolphins and Sharks, with reference to the copy shop. The allusion does come into the play, but you feel that it's brought in a bit, it's inserted, rather than being thoroughly organic. But at the same time, it's a good, solid play about an economy where some would say everything is a fix for bosses to profit from debt, even those who are employed in jobs in a retail concern, such as this copy shop. And it does feel as if they're all, in their various ways, prisoners of the copy chain gang. And it's also got to feel a bit of an updated Animal Farm within the copy shop, with everybody manoeuvring. And maybe the glimpse of a poster at one side where, at a distance, a picture of Barack Obama looks on the whole situation without trying to clarify exactly what the meaning is. But it does add to the whole atmosphere, and that it's trying to deal in an original way with political issues from an original standpoint. So I was quite, again, impressed by the play. In terms of the acting, I think that the upwardly mobile Ziamara, Rachel Hanshaw, who does say that she hasn't gone to college, she's the kind of apprentice-style woman who learns how to talk the talk and walk the walk. I thought she was very good. She got the feel between leaving what had been her allies behind, but for understandable reasons, trying to climb up the ladder, even if at times she wasn't sure where she was going. And I think the janitor, Danilo Jamilo Miguel Aquino, also gave a good performance. Quite a hard thing to do, in a way, because he was at first not realizing exactly what was happening. And then he begins to, you can see in his face, he begins to have misgivings, but he pushes it away because Ziamara was somebody that he's grown up with. I think the grit, though, is in Chico Amos's Isabel, the mother of three, who finds herself totally at sea in the end. She's been confident in her role at the copy shop, but begins to be pushed away by this whole corporate setup, even though she and Ziamara have in fact indulged in the same little tricks and ways in the shop previously. But suddenly that seems to turn upon Isabel. It's worth knowing, actually, and I looked it up afterwards. I didn't realize that. And this is, again, perhaps a slight flaw in a play which is very much rooted in a locality, that the activist, the elderly lady Amenza, had been working to save something called the Renaissance Theatre and Casino, which in fact this was, as I say, done in 2015. And I think that that whole campaign had already fallen through, and there were questions about the whole financial setup of some of the organizations involved. Obviously, this is local knowledge, which shouldn't really impede the enjoyment of a play, but I think it takes away one dimension not knowing this, especially with some of the final moments of the play. I think this was an intriguing play. It held me. It had very good performances. I think the role of Yusuf suffered a little bit from being not quite as rounded in the way it was written as some of the other characters. But again, the actor Amadoufos came across well, again with great clarity. And this is also, of course, due to Lydia Parker's direction. There was a lot to like. It was a little bit heavy-handed in its use of metaphor sometimes, but it held me, and I think it was it's talking about vital issues in an original setting, and I did like it.
I'm not sure I have too much to add to that. I mean, certainly I thought it was well performed, well put together. It's a very, you know, well-directed play. I thought that there are bits of heavy-handedness there. Certainly the last bit of the play, I'm not sure that it earns that, the last thing that happens in the play, which, you know, you're certainly I found myself engrossed in the story that was going on, rather than all the political themes behind it. You could certainly see them, but then suddenly, towards the end, it does get very political, and, as I say, this end bit, which I don't think the play quite earned. It sort of brought you to a point and then had to work out how it was going to end, which I didn't think quite worked for me. The rest of the play is very interesting, good fun, and, as you say, well acted. It's a nice piece. I'm not sure that I'm going to be rushing to see the next thing this writer writes, but it's certainly something that I'm not going to not go to it, especially if it's well directed like this piece is. I'm now going to talk about The Knowledge at the Charing Cross Theatre. This is a play adapted by Simon Block from a screenplay by Jack Rosenthal, and it's directed by Jack Rosenthal's widow, Maureen Lipman. It has a set designed by Nikolai Hart Henson and a costume designed by Jonathan Lipman. The original film of The Knowledge was made in 1979 and set then, and concerned a group of four Londoners attempting to do a thing called The Knowledge. This is the training regime they have to get a green badge enabling you to drive one of the famous London black cabs. They are up against an extremely eccentric examiner, Mr. Burgess, who is known as the vampire, and he is extremely obsessed of keeping up standards. The film of The Knowledge was very well received at the time and is reasonably famous. In fact, many cab drivers, especially people old enough to have seen it, often say that it's one of the things that made them think of going in for cab driving. It certainly revealed how difficult it is to become a London black cabbie. You have to memorise about 400 routes. They take you through about 25,000 streets in a 6-mile radius from Charing Cross Station. And you also have to learn all the points of interest, half-mile corridor either side of the road, for all of these routes. So London cab drivers have an enormously encyclopedic knowledge of the streets they know. And even today, it's thought to be almost as good as sat-nav, and sat-nav can't quite beat it yet. And one of the things that this film did is it really burnished their reputation for being brainy as well as extremely opinionated. The other thing that this film did is it introduced in the character of Mr. Burgess, it introduced the world to the actor Nigel Hawthorne. Nigel Hawthorne had been knocking around for quite some time, but had never really found the right role. And in this, it really brought people to his attention. And obviously Nigel Hawthorne went on to do things like Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister and really became a very interesting figure. In fact, one of his co-stars in The Knowledge, Jonathan Lynn, wrote Yes Minister, so perhaps that's kind of how they met. Now, the story adapted for the stage, they've reduced the number of male cab drivers attempting to do The Knowledge from 4 down to 3. We still have the rather mysterious Miss Staveley, who is also trying to do The Knowledge, but you never really find out about her, only as the numbers of cab drivers get fewer and fewer, she's always still there. She's still able to keep up with the boys, but you never really find out an awful lot about her. Basically, it's done with, but the three men are each in relationships, two are married, one just has a girlfriend. So we have Chris, played by Fabian Frankel, who is pushed into doing The Knowledge by his girlfriend Janet, played by Alice Felgate. He's very unwilling and she's very pushy, and actually, rather comedically, she ends up almost as good as him at The Knowledge, and you sometimes kind of think that she should do it. It's a very nice pairing. Fabian Frankel is very useless to begin with, but he blossoms as he gets better and better at it. And Alice Felgate is a really nice sparring partner with him, and somebody who really wants to see some get up and go out of him. But in the end, he becomes a little bit too obsessed by it, and we get this idea of the Knowledge Boys' wives. Knowledge Boys being the young men you see on their mopeds with a little clipboard in front, even today, rushing up and down the streets, trying to learn all the routes that they have to. Another couple are Ted Margolis and his wife Val, played here by Ben Kaplan and Jenna Organ. Jenna Organ was in Bad Jews, which ran in quite a few places around the West End a few years ago, and she's very good fun. Ted is the scion of a family of black cab drivers. He's always been a bit put upon. He's a bit bullied and he wants to prove himself. And in fact, initially, he does seem to be doing rather well at it. He's got a very good memory, possibly an eidetic or a photographic memory, so he can remember an awful lot of detail. And he appears to be flying through the knowledge, although something's bound to get him caught up. Then we have Gordon Weller and his wife, Brenda. Gordon is played by James Alexandru, and Brenda is played by Celine Abrahams. Gordon uses the knowledge to be able to get out of the house and travel in places and pick up women and sleep with them, and he's not a particularly nice character. Although it has to be said, I mean, I've heard James Alexandru, who you first met when he was a young boy actor in EastEnders, and people didn't really get on with him. He seems to have developed into a really nice, solid actor in this, and I found him rather impressive, having seen him once before and not being too impressed by this. But he makes a very good fist of this role. I was rather impressed by all the acting in this particular production. I have enormous affection for the original film, and this reminded me how much I liked it. And I think in some of the criticism that I've seen of this play, that's what they're basically saying. After all, you can buy the knowledge. It comes on a DVD with a set of DVDs of all of Jack Rosenthal's ITV plays. I think it was originally done for ITV. So you can do that and you can see that instead of spending the money on this. It would be slightly cheaper. But there is something to be said for this particular production, especially you've got a very nice performance as Mr. Burgess by Stephen Pacey, who doesn't do it exactly like Nigel Hawthorne and is in fact rather more eccentric, I think, than Nigel Hawthorne's original way of doing things, especially when he's trying to distract them while they're doing their various routes. Another thing that I felt added to it, this is something, as I said, that a lot of cab drivers of a certain age remember this film, and it brought them into it and it made them feel special in some ways. And on the night I went, there were a lot of cabbies in the audience. And when people are on the stage are reciting the routes, you'd often get cabbies reciting the routes along with them, the routes that they had to learn. I mean, it was, as I say, a very good film. I think they've made a very good version of it in this play. And if it's still on, yes, I would definitely recommend people go and see it.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.